This is Shudders Inc. with Bruce Williams and Glyn Lavender.
Hi, and welcome to episode 212 of Shudders Inc. This is Bruce Williams from Shudders Inc. podcast, and joining me on the line via Skype from Melbourne once again, Mr. Glyn Lavender. How are you, mate?
I'm excellent. Thank you very much.
Good to hear.
I always am, though. I've never anything but.
That's right. As it should be.
Life's too short.
What's new in your world this week?
Oh, you know, just the joy of 7 days of a sick 2-year-old. But you know, other than that,
that's rough.
Yeah. I mean, the fever hasn't got below about 38 for 7 days, and it's taken a toll, I've got to tell you.
It's got to be pretty close to having run its course by now, surely.
Well, yeah, as I said last week, I think I might go put him in the car or something, and you know, starting to cool down a bit at night, so I'll pop the feet, sure.
Maybe that's what's heating her up, mate. You're leaving her in the car.
They were pretty lucky, actually, because you know, the antibiotics they gave her last week have done the job, and they've killed off whatever bug she had.
Oh, okay.
She's just got another one.
Oh,
yeah, she goes to childcare. We call childcare reinfection.
Yeah.
So just send her off to reinfection and see what she comes home.
I do remember that period of Max's life. They do. Yeah. They just pick up every disease known to man about.
It's just a petri dish of filth, those places. Bring your kids here and see what we can give them.
Yeah.
So we've had another early pickup, another day not been doing any work, get anything done, because had kids strapped to your chest for the whole day.
And yeah, right.
I'm sure anyone out there who's a parent will have lived those joys.
More than likely.
That's kind of it. That's my week. I haven't taken any photos of significance over the course of the week, with the exception of my daughter. I took a couple of snaps of her, which I was rather pleased of. You know, the bribery work for 2 minutes to get her to sit still. And, you know, it's because you do the best sort of bribery. You know, if you let me take your photos, I'll unnail your hand from the floor. You approach it the right way.
You're heading off to North Queensland tomorrow, I hear.
Yes, up to Mackay.
Excellent.
I'm saying up in the country, Mackay. Can start getting practicing like the locals.
And how long are you up there for?
I'm up there for a whole 4 days.
Right, okay.
Well, I'm scheduled to be there for 4 days.
Okay.
Because there's apparently, they're about to flood. And my company Creative Photo Workshops, with the acronym CPW, has always been known as Can Produce Water. In preparation of me coming up there, 3/4 of the state is flooded.
Right.
And I'm sure I'll be able to add a little bit extra when I get up there. But apparently there's also a cyclone in the vicinity. Just a little extra drama. So I'm going for 4 days. I may be there for 3 months. I don't know.
I was going to say, you could be there for 24 hours or 24 weeks, yeah.
I've got the blueprint for the ark in my pocket, though, you know, so I think we should be okay. Just going to start collecting those animals.
Excellent.
So I think, you know, what kind of it does beg the question, though, what kind of camera gear do you take on an ark?
Not having seen an ark in my life...
It's going to be at sea for a while. You're going to need some sort of, you know, probably a solar battery charger, but if it's still overcast, it's not going to charge too well. Yeah. And I guess if everything's water, there's not an awful lot to take photos of.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's going to be a challenging few days of workshops.
I guess you could turn it into a seascape workshop.
Yeah, I'm taking my gum boots and my underwater camera, so I think between the two of them. Yeah. But trying to I think that we're going to be stuck inside the venue for quite a few days taking photos. So it does challenge the creative abilities to spend 3 days in one room and at the end of day three still be taking interesting photos.
So is this a natural light or is it artificial light?
It's a bit of a mix. It's natural light for 1 day, so that's going to be fun in a room with very few windows and pouring down with rain.
Yep.
Then next day's flash, and then flash two, which is... everything I didn't teach you about in Flash 1, because I wanted your money twice. Honesty threats. sorry, it's an idea creation day where we explore more stuff we can do with flash guns, honestly. Ignore that other bit that came out earlier.
Excellent. Oh, well, I suppose by the time this podcast comes out, you'll hopefully be back in Melbourne.
No, or next week's podcast is going to be blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Fingers crossed up your home and to a healthy family and a dry bed.
Yeah, fantastic. One of the things that I wanted to bring up this week, further discussion from back in the days when I was trying to do this podcast on my own about 10-stop filters. As listeners who've stayed with me over the last 6 months will know, I bought a filter, a 10-stop filter, six, 8 months ago now. Not a Lee Big Stopper. I bought the high-tech filter from the UK. And never had particularly brilliant results from it, and I couldn't understand.
In what way? Every
image came out lacking any reds whatsoever. It was all just shades of blue. There was virtually no red, part of the spectrum in the images. They all looked really soft. No matter what aperture or where I focused, they all just looked really soft, and the whole. Every image just looked like it had a layer of mud smeared across it,
And so just, if I'm just going to succinct this, that's not what you were going for in the image.
No.
Checking. Okay, so that was the bad stuff.
Yeah, it was not exactly what I was looking for. And I got into a conversation over the past week with Lee Gatland, who's based here in Sydney, and Lee just bought himself... surprisingly enough, the Lee Big Stopper.
The Big Stopper.
And, and this is sort of, I guess you'd say, the Rolls-Royce of 10-stop filters. It's the one that most people talk about, most often when talking about 10-stop filters. And so I said to him, look, be keen to see something when you do get out and, use it in anger. And, a couple of days later, he posted something on Facebook, and it looked fantastic. It was what I'd, always expected of a 10-stop filter.
I saw that photo. Yeah, just the little rivulet.
That's the one. Yeah. And I thought, what on earth is going wrong? And so we started a bit of a conversation.
You're a Nikon user, aren't you? Sorry,
Sony.
Oh, no, you're a Sony user, aren't you? That's right.
How could you forget?
You're the one.
The one and only.
You're the one.
That's it. And so we got talking about it, and he happened to just casually off the cuff mention light leakage. And so that got me investigating, and what I found was that the high-tech filter, when inserted into my Kokin P filter holder, doesn't actually seal completely around the lens. And
absolutely.
And so I found that, I think I'm on the track now, that the issue that I was having is light leaking in around the sides of the filter, and basically from the top and the bottom and from the sides, and leaking into the lens while the shutter is open. So
that makes all the sense in the world.
And obviously, when you've got, the shutter open for like minutes at a time, obviously, the entry to the lens...
doesn't need to be an awful lot of light coming in over that period of time.
No, exactly, so I need to do some experimenting. I've tried, using gaffer tape to close up the gaps all around the sides of the filter holder.
Yeah.
And that kind of works, but it's not a very practical solution, because when you use a 10-stop filter, you can't autofocus while the filter is on. So you basically need to set up your shot, get your focus, switch to manual focus, then put the filter on, and then close the... the little gate over your eyepiece, because you don't want light leaking in through there either. And then you obviously need to calculate, 1,000 times what your shutter speed was. No, I'm not kidding. It actually is.
You need your iCalc 4S.
Yeah.
Or maybe the new iCalc 5.
Yes, exactly.
Apple calculators. Yeah, they're fantastic.
So it's not very practical to be trying to, put gaffer tape all around the filter after you've attached it to your lens, because
you
don't want to be bumping your focus point. And so, yeah, so there's more experimentation still required, but at least I think I am now on the track as to why I've never got the sorts of results out of the 10-stop filter that I thought I should have been getting.
Interestingly,
someone months ago sent me a link to a magazine article that had been published in the UK where they had compared the Lee Big Stopper, the high-tech filter, I think there was a... can't remember what the other one was. There was another filter. Koken bizarrely don't do a 10-stop filter.
It's bizarre indeed. It's or any of the variations of those. It's crazy.
Yeah, they only go to an ND8, which is 3 stops.
But
interestingly, this magazine article, you know, commented on the fact that all of these 10-stop filters will introduce a slight color shift in one direction or another. Some of them tend to go warm.
Redshift or blue shift.
Yeah, some go warm, some go cool. They can always be corrected in post. And of course, you know, until I got onto this idea of light leakage, I was having no luck whatsoever correcting the, you know, quote unquote color shift that I was seeing in Lightroom. And sort of now I think, okay, well, the light leakage was probably a major cause of that problem. So.
And so I just did a quick search on the old internets and came up with quite a lot of people talking about exactly the same issue with the high-tech filters.
Right.
But apparently they've got a new one out, which is better.
Right.
So,
it has a foam gasket around the side of it, but it's obviously made to go with their filter holder. So I might have to splash out and get the high-tech filter holder. But, of course, then the downside of that then is that I can then only use, you know, their 10-stop filter and nothing else.
Yeah.
You know, one of the tricks that landscape photographers quite often do is they'll put in the 10-stop filter so that you can, you know, get some blur to your water and your clouds, but they'll then use a graduated ND as well so that you can suppress the sky and let the, you know, the foreground expose a little more.
Absolutely.
But that obviously requires a filter holder, which will allow you to use multiple filters and...
Or more gaffer tape.
Yeah, more gaffer tape, that's it.
The photographer's friend, it would make sense. I mean, just because you're lengthening the exposure doesn't solve the problem of the bright sky versus dull land.
Absolutely
so
not.
So you still have the same issues to deal with. It looks like from everything I can see in it, you're definitely not in your Pat Malone.
No. Right? No.
There's a lot of people with exact, but I see the same thing with the Big Stopper too. That people are saying that, you know, they've got blue casts.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, I guess it depends whether the light's coming towards you or the light's going away from you. You know, blue shift, red shift.
Ah, interesting. Right.
I mean, it could be total. You know what? But you know, if you look at stars, they can tell how far a star is traveling by the colour of light.
Yes.
If it's the light of blue light that's coming towards you or going away from you. Maybe. Yeah, light is light is light.
Yes, yeah, good point. Hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, I could be just totally pulling it out of my mind.
Well, I'd be interested to hear from anyone who's listening who has a 10-stop filter, who's had good results. Has that been your experience? You know, do you find that your filter, no matter which brand of filter you've got, does it change the colour of the shift depending on which way the light is approaching your camera, like whether the light source is behind your camera or in front of your camera?
Or any sort of astrophysicist photographers who could, you know, jump on board and talk to us about light.
Now, you mentioned that you saw somewhere on the interwebs today that there is a new Polaroid camera coming out.
Well, before we go to that one, since we're talking about light, I read this interesting thing this week on some tech geek site.
Yeah.
DPReview.com.
Oh, love DPReview.
Yeah, but you know, I'm not much of a tech guy.
Oh,
so
okay.
A lot of their stuff, you know, that's where we're very different, Bruce. Yeah, I feel deeply. Yeah, you think more. You know? So I'm not a tech guy. So all the stuff going on and on about technology and, you know, the nuances of difference between lens A, B, and C. You know,
yeah.
I'm not so fussed about it. As long as the gear does what I need it to do and the results are what I want, I don't really care how I get there in some ways. But this caught my eye because I'm also a geek, so I do like geeky stuff.
Yeah.
And I came across this thing called, they were announcing binary pixel technology.
Which is what?
That's what I said. Read my mind. Well, it's a new technology being worked on by the boffins, technical term for the people working on it.
Yeah.
I think look up boffins.com.au and it's got the whole gear about it. But basically, binary pixel technology is a new way of getting sensors to see light in a different way.
Okay.
Well, okay, maybe not so much in a different way, but how they record light very differently. And the end goal is to be able to get sensors that can produce what they're calling ultra-high dynamic range images, or beyond the old HDR-style images, without any form of processing.
Okay.
So actually having the sensor itself be able to capture a much broader dynamic range than they're currently capable of doing.
You know I get convulsions when I hear HDR, right? Because so much of it looks horrid.
Well, it does, but look, well, when done well, it can be phenomenally good.
Exactly.
So it's like anything. People say the word Photoshop, and some people go, oh, and some people cringe because it can be god awful, and it can be incredible depending on where your skill level's at with it. I do HDR on moderately regular occasions. I'm woeful at it. You know, I am that pixel vomit that you're talking about. But, you know, I'm a fairly over-the-top person, so fairly over-the-top photos tend not to. They tend to come out in the photos, you know, so it's not so bad. But this technology, but having its ability to capture it, I guess, straight out of the camera, as opposed to letting the human influence slide sliders until things go too crazy.
Right.
Could be a way of producing images that to now have not really been possible.
Okay, so how does it work? What's it doing?
Well, from what my feeble brain sort of gathers, is what it does is, so it turns the sensors on and off as they start to capture too much light. So let's say you're doing a landscape and the sky is pretty bright.
Yep.
Well, the sensors that are capturing the sky, when they get to the point of sort of saturation, they turn off. And then a computer resets the sensor to start recording light again.
So this is happening multiple times during the, 100th of a second that your shutter is open.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
And exactly how many times, I don't know. It's allowing itself to capture more and more detail in the bright and dark areas by this technology.
Right. Interesting.
Well, it's different. It certainly can show us where a lot of the people are thinking this sensor technology is headed, because we're in the very early days of sensor development, I guess you'd say.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
An awful, awful, awful long way to go. And everything from the way they capture and everything, the way they're made and built is changing dramatically. So this is just yet another way. At the moment, they're working with very small sensors, even much, much smaller than a cell phone sensor.
Right.
But their goal is to develop it up so cell phones can capture the same dynamic range as an SLR.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously I'd imagine if they want to make more money, then to go to the full as big a sensor as they can manufacture using this process.
Right.
And in some ways it could be incredible.
Yeah, you know, it makes me... I think back to the days when Shelton was still on this podcast. We had a similar conversation long before this idea of ultra HDR was floated, but I remember making the comment about how, in the audio industry, the very first computers that were capable of capturing audio were only able to capture 8-bit audio because we didn't have fast enough hard drives, we didn't have enough RAM, we didn't have wide enough buses for the data to get onto the hard drives, and so we couldn't do anything more than 8-bit audio. Yeah. Which gives you very limited dynamic range. And then as the hardware caught up, we were able to then record 16-bit audio, which was at least up to the same level as what you put on a compact disc. And now we've got machines that are fast enough with hard drives that are big enough and oodles of RAM and wide buses. And, we can now do 32-bit audio and 64-bit audio and all that sort of stuff. And I sort of see the parallel with photography, but photography is like 20 years behind where audio's at. You know, it's still early days in this, you know, being able to capture dynamic range in the image sense of the, you know, the term. But, you know, obviously, you know, the same sort of developments in technology are happening in the photographic world. And, you know, 20 years from now, we'll be, you know, able to capture, you know, way more dynamic range than we can possibly use, which is exactly where we're at with audio these days.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah.
exciting it's, stuff.
At some point, well, as long as you can turn it off. Because the last thing I ever want to be able to do is, so I'm mostly a person shooter, people shooter, is to capture what I see with my naked eye.
Yes.
I don't want to capture detail in the shadows. I want shadows.
My answer to that would be that in the audio realm, we capture way more than we can use.
Yeah.
And like any production system, no matter what it is that you are creating, you always want to work with the highest quality assets for as much of the production cycle as possible. And then, you know, when you've created that art of whatever form it is, whether it be a piece of music or a radio commercial or, you know, or you know, you're putting together something in Photoshop, you want to work with the best quality assets all the way through. And then at the final output stage, you go, okay, now this is how I want to present it to the world. And that might mean that I don't present everything that I had, but at least I had the best quality assets to work with. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I tried to get it with the audio. Because you want to start with the best possible sound, and who cares if you're dumping it down to a low res for something else. But with visual, the problem is if you put a photograph, let's say, into Photoshop CS12 or whatever it'll be by the time this stuff comes out, and you can see everything you saw with your naked eye, how would you know what you could have got? How would you know where to, what to get rid of and how to get rid of them? How would you know, where would you know what the shadows are doing? If you've never seen it before, if you've only ever learned photography by what you see with your naked eye being able to be captured by the camera, how would you know how to do low-key photography?
The thing is that, if I understand it correctly, what this technology will allow once it has developed and has been, you know, brought out to us, the consumers, is it will allow you to capture an image the way you see it with your eye, but then be able to experiment with that stored data and go, show me what this would have looked like had I shot it five stops lighter or had I shot it five stops darker. And you will have so much information there that you will be able to make that radical an adjustment and still not clip at either extremity. You know, you'll have enough data to be able to represent the image exactly the way it would have looked had you actually exposed it five stops lighter or five stops brighter.
So no one's darker. A photographer anymore.
Well, that's always the risk, isn't
it? Other than composition, shoot it. It's a little bit like the Lytro camera, the light field camera.
Yes, you know those? Yes, absolutely.
Remarkable technology that you can take a photograph, then focus it wherever you want later on.
Yeah.
Which is good for people like me who always get photos out of focus. Very handy, but you know, once you've done it a couple of times, that was kind of fun. What's next? But where's the challenge in photography to go out and to work with light? Everything that photography's been since its inception, since an invention, you know, to write with light, all of a sudden that's thrown out the window because the camera sees everything.
Yeah,
but later on, you choose what you do and don't like. I couldn't imagine being very satisfying.
True.
From the shooting side, I mean, look, I love to pixel bash with the best of them in Photoshop. I'm no good at it. My Photoshop skills are a tiny percentage of what I'd like them to be. And I can only imagine what sort of scary results I could get out of if I actually used that program. But, you know, so whilst I love to experiment with Photoshop, the joy is really
in the capture.
The fun is there. Yeah. The only reason I really spend so much time, I guess, in things like Photoshop is that I can't always be taking photos.
Yeah.
But I want to be involved in my business, hobby, sport, whatever you want to call it, as much as I can. So I'm often just playing with photos just because I'm still involved in doing the thing that I'm passionate about.
Yep.
Yeah, and, you know, for the next 3 days in pouring it down with Mackay, we might be doing just that.
Run a one-day photo workshop, in like a Photoshop workshop.
Well, there's nothing else to do. We ran out of ideas to take photos in the one building that's not got rain in it. Yeah.
Well, I shall reading that DP review article with great interest, I can assure you.
I think it's an incredible technology, and certainly as a landscape shooter, I can see amazing potential. But you certainly the ability to scale it back, its sensitivity, I think, is going to be important. You know?
Yeah.
It might become like another dial in the camera. You've got your ISO, your shutter speed, your aperture, and your sensitivity. Yeah, your dynamic range. Another dial. Yeah. Just turn the dial to how you want to feel it. And then that way you could at least capture it the way you could dial it down. Oh, what would it be like if I tried this? Mm. It gave you another creative element to be working with in the field.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, we just need to graft another thumb on or another finger. maybe we can move their nose and we can just, as we look through the viewfinder, just going to move our nose to the left or right. And if I went muffled there, it's because I was actually trying it in real life. I'm a visual person. That comes across so well on radio, of course, on podcasts. be tempting to use a faux camera with this new HDR dial. But I guess that could be a very cool thing if you do have this extra knob on your camera.
Yeah.
Because you could start out, you could do a low key and then build the light.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
It will be very interesting. So can we now go back to the Polaroid camera?
Oh, yeah, I suppose. As I said, I'm a geek and I'm a bit of a gadget guy. And I've been around this business so long that I remember the joys of holding a Polaroid Polaroid photo under your armpit to make it develop faster.
Oh, I never heard that trick.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Shove it up there, warms it all up, and it develops in 48 seconds instead of 52 seconds or something. That's
worth the investment.
That's almost 10%. That was a 10% increase, Sure, all your underarm shirt of your shirts had chemicals all over them, but other than that, don't worry. You can always tell a Polaroid photographer by as soon as he lifted up his armpit. No, but I did see that Polaroid have announced an Instagram camera.
Okay.
So it looks, if for those of you who use Instagram, it looks exactly like the icon for the app on your iPhone or your Android.
Right.
It looks just like it, but big, and it's real. So the joy is you can go, you can shoot with this camera with all the same filter effects that Instagram have. And after you've shot it, it automatically loads to Instagram. But then going back old cool retro old school stuff, it also prints out the photo.
Straight out of the camera body?
Out of the camera. Yeah.
Okay.
It's like going back having an old school Polaroid, looking, there's your shot, but it's already digitized and uploaded to Instagram for you as well.
Wow. Okay.
I'm
different.
It's a lot of you know what it is? It's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you go to a party and you pull out your Polaroid and you start shooting people. Everyone can see them online. You've still got the copies of the photos. You're having a ball. It's putting some fun. I'm getting one. Let's put it that way. As soon as it comes out. So if anyone from Polaroid's listening, I'll please email me and I'll send you my postal address. Just 10 will do for starters. And only a year supply of film.
Yeah, of course.
Film was always the expensive part.
Yeah, right.
When Polaroids were almost at the end of their life as the old analog Polaroid cameras, I think it was costing about $4 a photo to take.
Ooh, wow.
So you have to be fairly committed to the Polaroid love,
to
spending that sort of money on a and people. Yeah, then it stopped being made altogether, and then some amazing people who were so passionate got together and said, "Nope, we're going to revive the company," and they started a thing called the Impossible Project.
Oh, okay.
That was to get Polaroid back and running as an analog film, and they did it.
Wow. Yeah.
And they're still out there. They're still making. They're still coming out with all sorts of cool new versions of Polaroid film, which is pretty amazing.
Right.
So that was my gadget of the week anyway.
Yeah, okay.
On Instagram camera.
Now, you've been watching a doco on Foxtel, you tell me.
I have, yes. I've also been watching something on photography. Oh, I have. I stumbled across on the movie channel, of course, of all places. That's where you find your best documentaries. on the movie channel, a thing called Witness.
Okay.
It's a four-part US documentary on following around different war photographers in different conflict zones.
All right. Wow.
So I don't know what the online capability is to be able to get access to this program, or whether you can, you know, order it as a DVD. But it's enlightening, I guess. It's very fascinating to watch. I've known quite a few war photographers over the years, and it's an amazing thing they do. But basically the documentary is a camera crew following around a war photographer in these incredibly harsh zones and just seeing what they capture.
That's very meta, isn't it?
Amazing, yeah.
Very meta, the idea of a camera crew following a photographer who's following a war.
Yeah. Well, but then, of course, there's the behind-the-scenes camera crew filming the guys who are filming the guys. I was talking to a guy recently. There's a band called the Birds of Tokyo,
for those young
hip people who know these things. Well, they had a fairly good videos made up for their last album.
Right.
Well, I knew the guy who did the behind-the-scenes video, the guy doing the video of the video.
Right. So,
you've got to have all these layers these days. You can't just film the thing. You've got to do the behind-the-scenes. That's when all the cool kids want to watch how it's done. I'm waiting for Witnessing the Witness documentary. Right. It's the guy who filmed the guy. But, you know, it's the final scene of, I think it was either the first or second episode, really brought, it was in Mexico, and it really brought home the dilemma that a war photographer has, is in, do they get involved or do they just stay dispassionate and shoot? And I say this because there's an incident happened. It wasn't actually covered what the incident was. But he's running along, he's being chased, but the film guys are chasing him, going along, he's jumped down by this crashed car. Inside the crashed car is this guy who's been shot several times, either through the back or the stomach. And he's just lolling about in the car. Well, actually, first up you think he's dead, but then he starts to move.
Right.
He starts calling for help. Help me, get me a hospital, help me. And all the guy does is take photos.
Okay.
And then the guy staggers out of the car and lays on the ground. And all the guy does, and all the film crew is filming the guy does, is take photos of this guy dying.
Oh, wow.
They don't know if he dies or not, because they don't cover that. But as they pull back, they see this whole bunch of army guys or police, militia, just standing there with guns watching him die as well. It's very confronting. I mean, what do you do? Do you shoot? Do you record? Or do you do something?
That would be a nasty situation to be in as a photographer, because if you have any sort of humanitarian bone in your body, then your natural instinct would want to be to help the guy. But not only are you then being distracted from what you're being paid to do, but you also run the risk of then incurring the wrath of whoever inflicted the injury on the guy in the first place.
It could have been this guy standing next to you with guns.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're helping this guy. Yeah, exactly.
Then suddenly become an enemy combatant.
Exactly.
Whether you like it or not.
An accident of friendly fire.
Exactly.
But it's a fascinating, fairly harrowing, but fascinating documentary to watch. So,
wow.
If you've got access on the internet somewhere or...
Do you know which company produced the doco?
If you give me here, this is live
research.
Witness photography war. That should come up in Google, shouldn't it? Witness photography and war. Goodness, what's going to come out? HBO. There you go.
Oh, wow.
Real time shocks. So there's also a whole bunch of interesting articles from the New York Times that are talking about it as well, and talking about the dilemmas. And so it's pretty fascinating if you want to,
I shall be looking for that.
Insight into that. Insight involved.
I love HBO. I mean, in terms of dramas, they come out with some amazing stuff. So I would imagine that their docos are as equally well produced. So
very, very interesting stuff. So I've got the last episode on my hard drive, my Foxtel hard drive, to watch. Saving a time when I don't have distractions of family around, because it's not necessarily the sort of stuff you want with the kids around the house.
Absolutely.
But once again, there is some amazing stuff. Now, let's throw another call out to the listeners. do they have any great documentaries? Is there anything that they've seen on photography that's like, yeah, really floated their boats?
Yeah.
Put it on the Facebook page. Tell us about it. You know, give us an insight into to what they're watching too. I'd love to see that.
Yeah. You discovered any new blogs this week?
Well, funny you should mention that. Yeah, we did that. You know, it's that wasn't rehearsed at all. Fantastic. Unfortunately, I didn't say any of this, so it's just between you and me, Bruce. No one will know.
Excellent.
Well, actually, funny you should mention that. In a roundabout manner, I came across a New York Times blog called Lens.
Okay.
And it's all about photography, funnily enough, and which is strange, that. One of the articles that led me to it was on ethics in photography.
Okay.
And you know, basically, the discussion was about a magnum world-renowned photographer who submitted some photos to the World Photo Awards, and he came second. So he got all these prizes, and the photos weren't really what they were purported to be, and they weren't really the people they were supposed to be in the places they were supposed to be doing the things they were supposed to be doing. And you know, there's lots of toing. So that was interesting in itself. But what I liked about the site, this Lens site, and we'll put a link on the Facebook page if you want to have a look at, is it's basically great documentary photography and insight into what was shot and why was shot and what's going on. It's getting a bit more of the story than just an image. You know, if you want to sit down, I suppose it's like reading a good book. You sort of learn every post is a chapter about a particular image and what's been happening in the politics or happening in the lives of these people. It's quite fascinating.
Yeah, right.
So Lens, a New York Times blog, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, like I said, as Glenn said, the link to that will be in the show notes, which will be posted both at shuttersincpodcast.com and on the Shutterzinc Podcast Facebook page. Now, you're organising passports, I believe, for India.
You know, I found myself with a window of opportunity of 5 days.
Okay.
And I said, what can I do in 5 days?
I can spend 2 days travelling to India and 2 days coming back, which will give me a day to shoot.
It's a day to get there. day and a half, yeah.
Okay. Well,
much, yeah. So I've got this little window of opportunity. So excellent. I'm going. I'm off. Yeah,
awesome.
Leaving the 17th of March and come back on. I've got to be back to the 22nd because I've got a workshop on the 23rd.
Right.
So I've got those 5 days, including 2 days of travel. So about 3 days of shooting when I'm over there.
So you're just going on your own?
Yeah. I'm building a new travel photography documentaries in my head now. Workshop.
Oh, okay.
On what I want to do as a travel workshop is base it all around one event as opposed to all the images I've collected over the years, because there's no coherence to the story if it's just random images from all over the place.
Right. So when you say one event, you mean like one cultural event happening in that?
One trip. So basically, how did I research the trip? What resources did I use? What websites did I use? What was my planning beforehand? What apps do I have on my phone that help me when I get there? Then it'll be, okay, these are the locations I wanted to shoot. Then it's talking about, well, what went wrong? Yeah, because whenever you travel, things always go wrong. So you got to the location, it wasn't what you thought. What did you do? How did you shoot it? How was it different? And build a workshop about travel photography, all based around one trip and all its pitfalls and unexpected surprises. And that way, it has a great cohesion to the story of how you're trying to teach someone. Because people who come to a travel workshop are usually going on a trip.
Right, so I get it. I misunderstood. Yeah. I thought you were going to lead a photo tour, but you're not.
No, I'm just going there to shoot. I've got a series of images I need to tell a story about how to shoot a travel workshop.
Yeah, right.
And so I was just thinking, if you do it all in one trip, it'd be kind of handy. But here's the thing, you know, so I've got this great idea. Fantastic, yeah. I'll head off. You've got to have 180 days on your passport.
Yes,
Mine runs out in July, you know.
So you got to get a new passport.
So it's like a month. I mean, what a bizarre thing. I'm going for 5 days. And 100 odd days beyond that, my passport runs out.
I do not understand that. You know, if you've got if you're wanting to book a return flight, you know, clearly you are going and you are leaving.
A return flight's only about $100 more than the actual one-way flight, so it could be a con to make them think that you were going.
Oh, okay.
So that's what I would do if I was going to go somewhere to stay. And didn't want them to know about it. I buy a return ticket to kind of throw them off the scent, you know.
Yeah, right.
It's just my evil mind.
But, I mean, surely it would be easy enough to generate a report. You know, if you were the, you know, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade or whatever they're called these days, to find out, you know, who came into the country and had a return ticket and didn't get on the plane and leave when they were supposed to. I mean, that surely wouldn't be that hard to track down.
The theory's good, isn't it? Look at someone like me who's a regular traveller. I mean, they'll be able to see my passport. I'm in and out of places all the time for fairly short periods of time. So there's, should be no... But, so now I'm on the mad panic rush to try and see if I can get a passport. And I'm on a UK passport just to make it more challenging.
Okay.
So I'm now in this mad panic rush to try and get
So you've got about 10 days to get a new passport.
Yes.
Right, good luck with that.
And I'm away in the guy for 4 of them. if that particular trip's not postponed a week or two until my next window of opportunity, basically. But it's adds to the challenge of travel, doesn't it?
We're in much the same boat, actually, because Kath and Max and I have just booked our family vacation for this year. We're going to Borneo in June.
Fantastic.
Yeah, which I am super excited about. But Max was in the same boat. His passport runs out in July. Admittedly, we are right up against the expiry date of his passport, so we'll have to get a new passport for him. But it kind of got me thinking about that whole thing of, you know, as you said, what is it, 180 days?
Yeah, 180 days.
That's 6 months.
Yeah, it's half a year.
It's bizarre. It's like, why bother giving me a passport for 10 years? Why not just make it a 9.5 year passport?
Because then it'd run out in 9 years. I'm buying a 10-year passport, give me a 10.5 year one.
Yeah.
Give me a bonus 6 months that I can throw away at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
I want my 10 years. I don't want my 9.5 years.
Because it's fairly universal. Pretty much all countries are the same, aren't they?
It seems to be, tell me, though, why Borneo?
Why Borneo? That's a good question. We were going to... originally, we were looking at Vietnam.
Yeah.
And what we wanted to do in Vietnam was just a little bit outside of our budget. And we thought, rather than curtail the scope of the trip in order to fit the budget, let's just find something else that we want to do that will fit within the budget we've got. So... as it turned out, we were looking at other Southeast Asian countries that we would have been interested in going to visit, and let's face it, there are a heap of them, all of which would be very interesting, not only photographically, but just, culturally. I'm the kind of guy, if I travel internationally, I don't like spending my time where all the tourists hang out. I would rather get off the beaten track, and just go and, hopefully go where there aren't that many tourists and really absorb the culture of whatever country I'm in.
Exactly.
And Borneo seemed like the kind of place where you're not going to find a lot of tourists, or if you do find tourists, they're going to be like-minded individuals in that sense that they want to get off the beaten track and see a bit more of what the planet has to offer. So, yeah.
That's why I never go to places like that. The last thing I want to find is like-minded people. Find anyone like me. My goodness. But look, Borneo, it'd be fantastic. So we're looking forward to some amazing photos, no pressure.
I'm looking forward to it. One thing that I am going to have to look into, and I'd be keen to get any input either from yourself or from the listeners, wet weather gear. What would be the best things to carry in terms of you know, protection for my camera, because I would imagine, you know, this is one of those countries where the wet season lasts 10 months of the year. Exactly. So,
They have warm rain and cold rain.
Yeah, pretty much. So I'd be interested to get feedback from, you know, anyone as to what sort of gear should I be stocking up on to keep my camera gear protected from the elements in a, you know, wet jungle.
Yeah, a lot of the problem is humidity more so than the actual rain itself.
Right.
Just stuff that's sitting in your bag is growing stuff. Basically,
right.
You'll have fungus start growing out of your lenses 6 months after your return.
Right. So lots of little sachets of moisture absorbing.
Yeah. And make sure you buy fresh stuff, don't it? Because that stuff dates and goes off. But as far as protection for the camera, I use a thing called a storm jacket. I'm not even sponsored by. What am I doing? So a storm jacket by Vortex Media. I'll send my send me an email. I'll send you my poster. it's a great little thing. It's basically just a piece of flexible, almost like raincoat material with just like two little pull stops on either end.
Right.
So you just behind the lip where your lens finishes, just behind the filter lip.
Yep.
Pull it tight so it's locked in.
Yep.
Goes all around the camera. You've got a big hole in the back so you can look through and see your viewfinder. You can pull that tight as you want and you're as protected as you're going to get.
And it's storm jacket.
Storm jacket. They're awesome. $40 or $50 or something. But
okay.
They're very, very cool little tools. If I'm going those sort of places, I'll never not have one on me.
And so do you have to have a different one for each lens or?
No, because it's a big bag basically. Basically, you're taking your camera and shoving it inside a big bag.
Right.
But the bag has these little ziplocks on either side, so it actually form fits around your camera.
Oh, okay. So they sort of extend and contract.
Yeah. Well, it's basically, even not so much, think of it as a plastic bag, an expensive plastic bag.
Right.
Or you could just take a plastic bag. think of it as so it's flexible like a bag would be. It's more of a raincoat material, but you can get them for a range of size cameras and a range of size lenses. So you buy it for the gear with the biggest lens on, and of course it'll fit everything else.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Really, it's just the one. And it comes off in about 2 seconds flat, which is great. And if you're changing lenses, pop straight back on in about 2 seconds again.
Yeah.
Now, the very, very front of your lens is going to get wet, so you might get some water on your filter, etc., but that doesn't matter. That'll dry off.
Yep.
So that and a whole stack of silica gel.
Yeah, right. Interesting.
And then there's stuff like, depending on if you're inside an air-conditioned room and you want to go outside and shoot, you've got to acclimatise your camera. You can't just walk outside.
Yeah, right.
So the old trick I used to use is try and put a bike in the house. So I used to be in a house and I spent a fair bit of time up in Alberta in Canada.
Okay.
Minus 45 every day.
Wow.
So you couldn't walk from indoors to outdoors with stuff because they'd shatter basically.
Yeah. Right.
So you had to acclimatize your gear before you go outside. So you'd move it closer and closer to the back door.
Right.
And basically, the internal temperature of the building changes, and in the case of a humid place, it gets more and more humid, but slowly.
Right.
And by the time you've got it sitting outside, sitting by the back door for a few minutes before you go out, it's mostly acclimatized. You won't get all the fogged up lenses and all the other dramas you get in those sort of environments. So, or try and get it somewhere, if you're in a hotel room, try and find somewhere where it's not being air conditioned.
Right.
Yeah, keep it as warm as possible before you go outside, and that'll help.
Yeah, right.
So those kind of little tips there. But please, send us your travel tips, people. We want to see.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know we've got people listening to this podcast who travel extensively. I won't go naming names, Malcolm Fackender. So I'd love to hear more tips from those of you who are experienced travellers. And particularly anyone who's been to climates like that, that are sort of equatorial and notoriously wet. I mean, I think the things you've mentioned, Glenn, are great tips, and I will certainly get some packets of silica gel absorbers to stick in the camera bag.
It's just the basic.
I'm assuming you can buy them in bulk.
Exactly. You just go to the chemist.
Oh, okay, cool.
Then the chemist is the best way to do it. Malcolm, as you mentioned, he runs, we may as well give it a little plug.
Yeah, absolutely.
He runs a company called Spotlight on Asia. Yes. He does do photographic tours into that. So, I mean,
he does.
If anyone's done a fair whack of tours into those areas and dealt with the problems that you're going to be dealing with,
it'd be Malcolm.
He better come through with some tips.
Yeah.
Oh, and Malcolm, that email you sent me last year, I'm getting to it, dude.
Oh, dear.
It was only like October. I mean, it's only been like 5 months.
Well, that was the end of last year. That's just nothing.
It's not like the middle of it or something, no, you know?
Exactly.
If I get to him before October this year, it's inside the same year. Well,
that's right.
But I'd like to hear more about what he does, because it's. I always love people who travel for photos. It's always great viewpoints to. Yeah. Because unfortunately, a lot of people in this world, myself included, have to travel with family, and I'm sure you're the same. We don't travel to shoot.
No.
We travel with our family and we get some opportunities to shoot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And, you got to spend the morning doing the old breakfast in bed and fluffing the pillows and doing whatever it takes to get that hour or two leave pass. Yeah. Yeah, like this trip into India for me, and whenever I travel to shoot, it's just such a glorious experience. Yeah, you've got 16 hours in a day you can be shooting if you want to.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly freeing thing. So that's one of the great things about going on a specialist photo tour.
Yes.
Is everyone's got the same like mindset. No one minds if you pull the bus over 17 times during the day. And I said hanging around with people who are prepared to shoot for 12 to 16 hours alongside you is always a lot of fun. So
absolutely.
Maybe I'll take a few people into India with me on another trip. Who knows?
Cool. All right, mate. Well, thank you for that.
It's been a lovely time talking with you.
It has. It has been a great variety of conversations this week.
I think every week's going to be like that, I think.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, that's good. Yeah. I think that's great. I think that hopefully we'll, put a little bit of something for everybody into the podcast. So.
Yeah, fantastic. And we've got some special guests coming up over the coming weeks as well, we should mention, to try and, whet people's appetite.
Hopefully next week we'll be talking with Les Walkling again. I had Les on probably 10 months ago talking about colour profiling of monitors and things like that. Les has got a series of workshops coming up around the country, so I've invited him onto the podcast. So hopefully we'll have him next week.
You're bringing competitor workshop people on to talk about workshops.
Well, you don't cover that kind of stuff.
No, because he actually knows what he's talking about.
He does know what he's talking about.
He does. No, he's awesome. And I'd love to get along to one of his events. I'm supposed to be introducing him at an event in a few weeks' time, but next 2 weeks' time, but I'm unfortunately
But unfortunately, you'll be in India.
No, I'm actually supposed to be shooting nude women that night, so it's,
I think Les just lost.
Given the choice. I
think Les is going to miss out.
You got to work.
Yeah. Exactly. All right, mate. Well, you have a good week. Enjoy your time up in Mackay.
Yeah, and if I don't get blown away by the upcoming cyclone, I'll talk to you next week.
If I don't hear from you next week, I'll know that you're underwater. And, all right. Well, we'll look forward to talking to you next week.
Nice. Take care. Bye, everyone.
See you, mate.
Shutterzing, another audio2you.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out shutterzingpodcast.com or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@shutterzingpodcast.com.